From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. The human brain and new ways to understand, support, and work with it will be the focus when scores of researchers, clinicians, and entrepreneurs gather in Maryland next week for the second Brain Futures Conference. Today, we'll speak with an entrepreneur whose app helps medics track the brain health of deployed soldiers, and a pediatrician who uses neurofeedback to help students overcome attention challenges. Plus, we ask Professor Michelle Carlson of the Bloomberg School about her studies of senior citizens who tutor young kids. The more they volunteer, the more improvements she tracked in their brains.
You saw greater increases in the volume of the whole brain, the gray matter, and in particular a region of the brain that's really important to memory and to risk for Alzheimer's disease called the hippocampus.
It's On the Record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Tens of millions of Americans live with brain diseases and disorders. Millions more worry about whether their brains will stay healthy as they age, and whether their kids can take full advantage of the strength of their brains to learn and organize themselves. At the same time, technological advances are expanding what we know about how the brain works and what interventions could help it work better. The Mental Health Association of Maryland looked at this expanding multi-billion-dollar marketplace of technologies, practices, and products, and thought consumers could make better choices if experts shared and compared the evidence of advances in brain fitness. That led to the first Brain Futures Conference in 2015. The second conference next week at National Harbor, south of Washington, will gather more than 60 researchers, clinicians, and entrepreneurs. And full disclosure, I'm on the board of the Mental Health Association. One of the researchers and entrepreneurs is Corey Lathan, co-founder and CEO of Anthrotronics, a Silver Spring company that has created a mobile app for medics to track the brain health of deployed soldiers. Corey Lathan joins me by phone. Welcome to On the Record.
Thanks, Sheila. I'm happy to be here.
You argue that just as doctors routinely check vital signs of body temperature and blood pressure, they should be checking a brain vital. What would that measurement be?
So the general concept of a brain vital is that we actually track our brain health over time. It's very hard to measure a change in brain health if we don't have a good baseline, if we haven't tracked it. So a brain vital might be something as simple as a reaction time test. So for example, if you when you see a visual stimulus and you respond to it, like a brain game, that is actually reflective of your brain performance. Now, it's a very rudimentary brain reflex and is just looking at things like your attention and your processing speed, but these are building blocks. So your higher level functions like decision making and executive function are going to be affected if your basic building blocks aren't there. So what we've proposed is to measure some of these building blocks in a very simple, easy way so that you can track them over time to see if something has changed.
And you devised an app called Dana where you apply some of this in the field. You've used it with troops. Tell us about Dana.
The military was facing or is facing a lot of issues in deployed environments. Soldiers are exposed to environments that can cause blast injuries, that where blast injuries occur, which can cause concussions. They're also exposed to environments that could cause PTSD, post-traumatic stress, or even things like depression. And then just by from their workload, combat fatigue and stress is very common, insomnia. Every one of those things that I mentioned changes your brain function. The brain is very sensitive, and so our deployed soldiers were facing these issues, and the medics really didn't have tools to to measure when brain performance was being affected by just the nature of deployment. And so there was a real need for very simple tools for medics to try and monitor the troops' brain health over time.
How did you address that?
We didn't invent something new. We didn't pull something out of a hat. We looked at the existing science out there because computerized cognitive testing has been around for a long time. What we chose to do was to pick the brain games, so to speak. So imagine playing just a brain game on your cell phone. But we chose to pick the activities that had the best grounding in science in terms of being reflective of cognitive health, the tests that were most sensitive but not specific. We really wanted to say, is there a change in brain function? And then that information, just like your blood pressure or your temperature, would be put into a clinical context to figure out what happened. And then we also chose tests that really did not have learning effects, so that wouldn't be expected to change over time if you kept doing these tests.
So military and civilian scientists developed tests that could be taken on mobile devices. And in addition to the military version, you've now released commercial and consumer versions of the Dana app. Corey Lathan, how do you see Dana affecting how medicine is practiced at home?
I generate more data in a day than my doctor sees in a year just through my interaction with my smartphone and my computer and all of the data that's out there that I'm generating. I have a right to, and it also can help me manage my own health. And so we see brain function as being reflective in our day-to-day interactions with technology. So it's not just me asking you to pull up a Dana app and take a test. It's monitoring all of our behaviors in a way that give us insight into our health and wellness, so that we prevent things like Alzheimer's and depression, and so that we preserve our mental health and we preserve our cognition as we age.
So this is something you see individuals doing, using more than practitioners?
I think it's going to start ground up and top down. I think we have to have the movement in both directions. Clinicians are understanding that when they give someone a new medication for depression, for example, it would be great if they could monitor them remotely and make sure that their cognition, their brain function, was improving as they were as they're taking their depression medication, or when they start a new medication for Alzheimer's, to see that there actually is an improvement. But you also need to have the whole family involved. With an Alzheimer's patient, you have a caregiver, usually a spouse or a child, who's involved, and in fact their health is being affected by taking care of their loved one, and so their health is at risk. So it's going to be bottom up as caregivers recognize they have to take better care of their own health, and it's going to be top down as providers recognize if they don't take care of the caregiver, that when the caregiver gets sick, then they're going to be taking care of both of two patients now instead of one.
Corey, I appreciate your talking to us about it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Corey Lathan is founder and CEO of Anthrotronics, which has developed a mobile app to track the brain health of deployed troops and health consumers. She'll be discussing digital technologies with other health entrepreneurs at the Brain Futures Conference next week. This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Kast. Now we'll meet Dr. Naomi Steiner, a clinical associate professor at Boston University School of Medicine. She'll take part in next week's Brain Futures Conference. She'll discuss overcoming attention challenges. Dr. Steiner is a developmental behavioral pediatrician, also a research expert in ADHD and attention difficulties. She's created a training program for people who have trouble paying attention. When she joined us by phone on Monday, I asked her who that program called Attention Tutoring is designed for.
So when we started to think about helping students, this was around 10 years ago, and what educators and also developmental behavioral pediatricians, psychologists were starting to really realize was that it takes more than students just sitting down and learning math and learning reading and writing to be able to function and learn very well at school. They really need to also be able to pay attention, sit still, listen to the teacher, and get their homework done and their work done at school. And so this was a major shift in thinking about things. And so these were the students that we were primarily thinking thinking of, and we started with students who had ADHD, attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder.
And what is the core of your approach to them?
The thought that we had first was, could we do brain training in order to train basically the frontal lobes, the front part of the brain, and the areas that they're, the circuits that they're attached to? Could we train this part of the brain to increase the attention span in these students? And so mostly we did the neurofeedback approach right then, which was that we sat down and we did neurofeedback attention training.
Tell me what that is, neurofeedback attention training.
This type of neurofeedback aims specifically at increasing a child's attention ability so that they can switch their brain on faster, they can maintain their brain on longer, and they can actually finish their work. The thought behind this is that what we've noticed is that children with ADHD actually present with a decrease in so-called focusing brain waves, in the good focusing brain waves. Those are the better waves. Those are brain waves that show that your brain is alert and ready to learn. And these children have an increase in theta waves, and these are the drowsiness waves. So you can imagine that's not really a brain that's ready to sit down and focus. So you can imagine, too, that that's a problem for these kids. So we set them down in front of the computer and we did neurofeedback, which is basically they can look at the screen and they can see, for instance, if a dolphin is going to the bottom of the sea, that means to say that the brain waves, which are being picked up with electrodes from their brain, not into their brain, but the brain waves are picked up from their brain, everything is coming out. If the dolphin can go to the bottom of the sea, that means to say that the brain waves have increased in the good kind of brain waves, in the better waves. And that's the feedback loop. The child sees and feels that the child is focusing really well and continues to focus as strongly as it can so that the dolphin remains at the bottom of the sea. And that's why it's called neuro for the brain waves feedback, and that's the screen feedback that the child is getting.
So are you actually changing the brain in doing this training?
Yes. What happens is that the brain is plastic. The brain is able to change its networks. And as you do practice, and you practice this through the neurofeedback sessions, what we know is that the brain is able to train and modulate its brain waves. So the child will practice to increase these focusing brain waves, and over the sessions we'll be able to do this easier and easier, and also for a longer and longer amount of time. And that's why the child is able to switch the brain on more easily and to remain focused more easily, which is very important to get things finished, right? And yes, studies where students and adults have been put in functional MRI, so where they can have a look and see what's going on in the brain and compare brain areas, they have found positive, good brain changes in the parts of the brains which are related to focus.
You mentioned children and adults. I think some of us can imagine the brains of children being plastic, being able to change. But you have attention tutoring programs for college students and older people. Are brains capable of continuing this kind of change?
Absolutely. What we have realized is that a lot of people with ADHD, they were not necessarily diagnosed as a child. They were diagnosed as high school children or even as college students or as an adult. And so we do have experience with these older age groups of young adults and adults who have been doing neurofeedback, and we do know that their brains are still plastic and they can change. And in fact, they change very well, because what adults have, what children don't have, is something fascinating. It's called metacognition. And they can actually think even better about, oh, I'm doing neurofeedback and this is how it's feeling when I'm concentrating, so I'm going to really try to modulate my brain waves and to make my brain change in this manner.
Can this kind of brain training replace medication?
So what we have seen, and the study that I did in the Boston and the Boston area public schools did show that some children were able to decrease their medication, their stimulant medication, their stimulant ADHD medication, and some children stopped their medication. We're still in a situation where we can't predict this, so it could be and very probably is different for each child.
Thank you for telling us about it. Good luck.
Thank you very much. You're welcome.
Developmental pediatrician Dr. Naomi Steiner is a clinical associate professor at Boston University School of Medicine and creator of the Attention Tutoring Program. She'll be in Maryland next week to discuss it at the Brain Futures Conference. Quick break now on the record, then we'll talk to a Johns Hopkins professor about the effect of volunteering on older brains. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking this hour about advances in understanding how the brain works and interventions to make it work better. Dozens of scientific researchers, clinicians, and entrepreneurs will gather next week south of Washington for the second Brain Futures Conference, organized by the Mental Health Association of Maryland. Professor Michelle Carlson of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health will be discussing preventing cognitive decline as we age. She's an expert in what kind of impact social engagement has on the brain, both the brain size and its plasticity or ability to reshape itself. She's with me in the studio. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you very much, Sheila.
If I understand correctly, you have been studying for almost 20 years people volunteering in AARP's Experience Corps. Including volunteers in Baltimore. Experience Corps tutors, age 50 plus, work with school kids who are reading below grade level. What did you look at and what did you find?
Well, we started, it was a process that started with looking at this idea of purposeful social connectedness, meaningful engagement with others, and particularly younger children, trying to sort of identify the needs of a growing minds, a growing group of young minds, and how to harness the growing power of a generation of retired minds that had accumulated a lifetime of wisdom and knowledge, and how could we bring the two together to impart knowledge to help support the educational enterprise with the goal of teaching children to read so that they could go on and read to learn. And with that goal in mind, we started with a program that would help improve, get them involved in their local schools to volunteer 15 hours a week, which was a lot to ask of these individuals, but they were willing to give that time because they saw the need in their communities. And in doing that, we felt, we hypothesized that we would improve their physical function by having them move, get up out of bed, get outside, walk to schools, go up and down the stairs, get in and out of those little child-sized chairs. So in addition to increasing their physical activity, we thought it would improve their what's called their executive functioning, their ability to plan their day, to organize, to update information, to help children by doing multiple activities with them and helping the libraries. Many of the libraries in the schools we were working in were defunct because they didn't have the resources to pay for a librarian. So we were able to help our volunteers learn how basically reacquaint with the Dewey Decimal System, for example, and then learn how to pick age-appropriate books and get children excited about reading. When we were working with children in grades through kindergarten through third grade, so these are children who really need to become excited about reading, not see it as an impediment or a barrier. So those activities, the physical, the cognitive in terms of challenging and helping children learn to read and tutoring them, and then the social connectedness that they feel in working with the children, working with teachers in those various classrooms, and also working with each other in teams to create sort of a real critical mass in these local schools, we thought would really be a triple benefit to them, and that it would be measurable through their cognition. And as one volunteer told me, she said to me after the first year we were doing the program that it removed the cobwebs from her brain. And I thought, well, let's try and check that, see if that worked.
So you devised a way to actually measure that?
That's right. So we started with cognition because that's easier to look at. And when we saw that there were actually measurable changes in those who were volunteering for one academic year relative to those who were waitlisted, which is to say that they were going to volunteer the following year when we had room for them in the various schools, we found that the 6 months of participation actually did improve their executive function and their what's called speed of processing. And so with that evidence, we thought we're ready now to do the brain imaging. And when we did the brain imaging, we were astounded to see that the volunteer was right, that it appeared to the best of our ability remove the cobwebs in the sense that it actually, we were showing improved blood flow to regions of the brain called the prefrontal cortex that support executive functioning, which is very important to all of us every day. We're constantly using our executive functions to organize our day. So that was a very exciting finding.
So you could see blood flow.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point, did you also see a change in size of some regions
That's
in the brain?
Right. Yeah. So then from there, we went on to explore if we could see changes in their functioning that were measurable in terms of these improvements in blood flow, really increased efficiency of using energy in the brain. We thought, well, perhaps we can see actual physical changes in the size of the regions of the brain related to memory and executive functioning. And that was a bit harder to the hypothesis there is that the brain is so sufficiently plastic that we could measure using MRI an actual increase in volume. And there were some skeptics, but as we went forward, we found that over 2 years, 1 year and then a second year of service, we saw dose-dependent increases in the size of the...
Dose-dependent, meaning in this
right.
case, the dose is the time they're spending volunteering.
Exactly, that's right. Very compelling because there we could demonstrate that with greater exposure, you saw greater increases in the volume of the whole brain, the gray matter, and in particular, a region of the brain that's really important to memory and to risk for Alzheimer's disease called the hippocampus. It's tucked inside, and it's really kind of like a railway station in the brain. And this region is small. So our ability to detect increases in volume was really shocking even to us.
That's Professor Michelle Carlson of the Bloomberg School's Center on Aging and Health here on The Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about her research on the brain strength of older volunteers who tutor kids in AARP's Experience Corps. I want to pick up on some adjectives that you went through quickly. You talked about purposeful and meaningful volunteering. And I gather that's an important part of your analysis, social engagement with a purpose. Does activity have more impact on the brain if the volunteer sees it as giving back to others?
That's a fantastic question, and it is really is the key question. And we don't yet know the answer to that, but we're trying to explore that. And the reason we don't know the answer is because we know so little about the relationship between social engagement and essentially brain aging. How does it help us age better? Some believe that perhaps any social engagement may be beneficial.
So getting together for coffee,
right,
that's great.
That's right. But we don't know that to be true. And in fact, there are some data from other trials where social engagement is used as a control, meaning that people are sort of brought together just to kind of talk about educational opportunities. And perhaps that control is not as beneficial as more purposeful engagement, such as in digital photography and quilting activities. So there is limited evidence to suggest that just gathering people together to be social for the purpose of, essentially conversation may not be sufficient or as beneficial as doing something that is meaningful to you or to others. And so We've tried to address that question in some measure in the Experience Core by doing an additional analysis in the brain that I could tell you a little bit more about.
Sure.
One area of the brain that really merits more attention for its importance to social connectedness is the amygdala. And the amygdala is another highly plastic region of the brain that's just in front of the hippocampus. And they work in tandem. And the amygdala is really important if you think about your earliest memory. And sometimes your earliest memories are the ones that are most emotionally salient to you, like the smell of the perfume of your kindergarten teacher or something that really sticks with you. And whenever you see that or have that smell, that you have this immediate recollection of a memory from early childhood. It may be a memory that brings you great pleasure, for example. But the amygdala is very important to socially and emotionally salient information. And we hypothesize that if purposeful social activity is important in the through this Experience Core volunteering, perhaps we would see that these volunteers would show increases in the size of the amygdala. So we used a methodology developed by Mike Miller here at the Johns Hopkins School of Engineering, which allowed us to look at the shape, small changes in the amygdala, and look at it in relation to Experience Core volunteerism. And we indeed found, once again, that the volunteers relative to controls showed increases in the amygdala, and these increases were related to increases in the sense of generativity and in a sense of purposefulness. So those volunteers who showed improvements or increases in their sense of value actually showed the greatest increases in volume in the amygdala. What that told us is that there's this behavioral component that we're capturing that suggests that that this increase is related to the need to be needed. That as you get older, you don't have any less a desire or need to be valued, and that perhaps this may be another pathway through which activity gets into the brain and helps protect the brain and buffer it against the onslaught of just aging. Aging in the brain, it leads to shrinkage, but in addition to that, the amygdala is an important structure, for risk for Alzheimer's disease.
We should keep in touch with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sheila.
Dr. Michelle Carlson is Associate Professor of Psychology. She works in the Center on Aging and Health in the Bloomberg School's Department of Mental Health. She'll discuss her research at next week's Brain Futures Conference at National Harbor. Earlier, we spoke with two other brain researchers who are part of the conference, Corey Lathan, CEO of Anthotronics in Silver Spring, and Dr. Naomi Steiner of Boston University School of Medicine. We have a link to Brain Futures at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Glad you've been listening. Come back tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.